All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Everyone, thanks for tuning in to the first couple segments, that replay of our first ever KER Market Quick Take, where Shad and I really just shared our thoughts on the markets and what we saw at that Beaver Creek conference. We will be recording more of those because, hey, why not? We're in tune with the markets, and sometimes better just have us talk about it. That being said, back half of the show, we are now chatting with Mike Larson, editor-in-chief at Money Show. Mike, a lot for us to get to this week, news flow-wise, out of the Fed. We got the Fed rate cut, 25 basis points. They did not go 50. We also got the updated dot plot that shows two more rate cuts this year, or maybe just one 50-point rate cut. The Fed only has two more meetings the rest of this year, and one more 25 basis point cut next year. Really seems like the Fed has now moved forward some of these rate cuts that people have been expecting. The markets just continued to melt higher. Mostly it was a non-event for markets. That being said, yes, it was priced in, and yes, we are now, it seems like, in a series of rate cuts coming from the Fed while the rest of the world is slowing their cuts or on full-on pause. Mike, what's your takeaway from what we found out from Jerome Powell this week and the market reaction?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. You know, it's so funny because I was trying to think of how to summarize the Fed meeting for a brief video update I did after the news came out. And I basically latched onto that quote. It was full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. And I say that because heading into the meeting, you know, between the Trump administration getting their guy, forcing their guy onto the board before the vote and trying to force the other governor out based on some mortgage allegations and so on, and then just all the political pressure and everything. I mean, it was, I think Tim Rose, the Fed whisperer at the Wall Street Journal, called it the most interesting Fed meeting in a long time or something like that. Just because of all the stuff going on in the world and the political and the financial and the economic world outside of the traditional stuff that people talk about on Wall Street or focus on when it comes to the Fed. But in the end, what happened, right? The Fed didn't do nothing. It didn't cut 50. It did 25 bips, you know, outside of Mirin asking for, you know, 500 points of cuts or whatever he was projecting probably in the dot plot. You know, it was basically a consensus type announcement, a consensus type move. You know, in the press conference, Powell talked about wanting to have, you know, insurance cuts, basically risk management is kind of how he described it. And yeah, I think, you know, Wall Street seems to be on the same page as the Fed and expecting, you know, a couple more cuts, 25 bip type moves, but nothing out of the ordinary, no emergency cuts, no, you know, gosh, inflation's terrible. We're going to hold steady kind of talk. So, you know, Wall Street got it right. The Fed, you know, essentially did what it probably should have done. And all the other Sturm und Drang out there didn't really impact what they did. If you look at the dot plot, it is the one thing I think found kind of interesting about the Fed's projections is that they were a little all over the map. If you exclude what is probably Mirin, I mean, they're anonymous, but, you know, his projections are for some ridiculous number of cuts that isn't going to happen. But outside of that one dot, you know, there was a fair amount of disagreement about should there be no more cuts, should there be one cut, two cuts. So, you know, within a narrow band of a couple of cuts, the Fed is still a little bit undecided here. So I think, you know, I think the general idea of maybe a cut in October and December, and then, you know, let's see where we're at as we roll into the new year is probably about right, barring some crazy market reaction. And I think that's why the markets were able to handle it and move past. You know, we've been in this big picture trend of curve steepening, so short end yields falling more than long end yields because the Fed's cutting at the short end, but there's still some concerns about inflation longer term. So you're seeing the yield curve steepened, had uninverted and then steepened pretty dramatically in the last year. I don't think that trade's over. The dollar has been falling out of bed for months on end. It had the worst start to a year since 1973. A little bit of a sell by the news reaction after the Fed in this case. But longer term, I think that trend is going to be with us, falling dollar. And I think, you know, when it comes to precious metals, you know, the proof's in the pudding. Gold, silver, continuing to do very well. Same thing, a little bit of a post-Fed blip as people sold the news in that case. But that trend, I don't think, is over. So, you know, big picture, I think you still, you know, after what the Fed's done and expecting what I think they probably will do in the next few months, you still want to be short the dollar. You want to be long metals. You want to be generally long stocks. And you want to be, you know, playing for a steeper curve in the interest rate markets. I think those big picture trends are not over, probably not by a long shot.
Well, Mike, if we do see the series of cuts, you know, we got the first cut in. I think everybody expected that. But if we get, let's just say, two more cuts this year in the November and December meetings, are there any areas that are the interest rate sensitive parts of the market, those sectors that you got your eye on? I'm thinking about financials, and I'm also thinking about the small cap stocks. We've seen the IWM finally make a new high, and the small caps, since they borrow money and there are a lot of them are pre-revenue, it's germane to them. Any other areas that are interest rate sensitive that you think are worth watching?
Yeah, great point. I mean, if you looked, yesterday I was looking at how everything did in the first 24 hours or one day of trading post Fed, and the smallest cap stocks, the IWC, the micro cap ETF, was up more than the small cap ETF, the IWM, which was up more than tech, which was up more than the mega cap ETF. So essentially, just what you would expect to happen post Fed, where easier money has the biggest bang for your buck if you're a higher indebted corporation, US focused, whatever, i.e., small and micro caps, is what happened. So I think, the fact that those sectors and those parts of the market rallied the strongest, I think that's a bullish sign, generally speaking, for the markets. And I would also say that that's what you kind of want to see and need to see to know that this market's broadening out. I mean, look, I don't dislike tech. I think tech has a lot going for it. But you can't just keep buying the same seven names, Mag 7, like we did a year and a half, 2 years ago in this the earlier phase of this bull market. You got to start finding other stuff, and you want to see those other companies begin to benefit, and the benefits of easier money and stronger growth and everything else filter down throughout the markets. And indeed, that's what you're starting to see. So I think that's encouraging. And I think I'd be, again, keeping a close eye on the financials. That's one of those sectors that a steeper curve is ostensibly pretty bullish for, your traditional financials, your banks, and so on. IPO activity has been through the roof lately, which is good for your more Wall Street sensitive financial institutions, IBs, and so on. So if those parts of the market do well, then I think that could be kind of the torch bearing part of the market, if you will, that picks up from tech and continues to run. So I like what I see. I don't think those big t picture trends are over, and I do think that you're going to have more bang for your buck if you go down the cap spectrum, just because yeah, that's what you would expect to see benefit from some of these developments that we're seeing. And you are actually, just as we're talking here, I just put up a 6 month chart on my screen. The IWC, the microcap ETF, in the last 6 months is up just about 30%, whereas the Qs are up 26%. So, that sector is outperforming. Those smallest companies are outperforming tech, and you're probably going to see that continue to happen as money gets cheaper.
Well, we keep hearing just how important tech is because of how heavily weighted it is in those broad averages and how it continues to, I guess, garner still a bit of money, but that spreading out of money is important. On that aspect of spending money, some people are a little bit more concerned about the consumer, but lower rates, that might help the consumer. As you said, we're seeing a much better IPO market, and there's still just so much spending going on in AI. That seems to be the main driver of where money is being, I guess, circulated in these sectors, is tech companies spending so much on AI, but now that money going down the food chain. So, is it all about lower rates here? Do you see maybe individuals, other companies also being able to open up the wallet a little bit and spend? Not to the same extent of tech companies, but at least spend in different areas.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the AI spending has been through the roof, and not just directly on AI tech, but also all the stuff that enables it, whether it's the power grid, the data centers, the utilities that provide the juice, that provide, that power the computers in the data centers, and so on. So, like the AI spending boom, we on the podcast this past week, it was kind of a question: is it boom, bubble? Where are we at? And the general consensus there, and probably at money show events from some of the speakers that have been right about the sector that I trust, is that yeah, there's a ton of money being thrown at the sector, but the good times aren't don't look like they're going to be ending anytime soon. This doesn't seem to be an unsustainable thing. I mean, you look at what happened to Oracle just the other day. I mean, gosh, the stock had its biggest one day move since 1992 or something on enormous long-term contract backlog announcements. And companies are generally saying they're finding value in these AI investments. They're getting more productivity out of their workers. Their businesses are being made more efficient. So it doesn't look like one of those things where, you buy some whiz-bang type technology and it doesn't actually do anything for your bottom line. So I think that part of the market can continue to be strong. You're right that retail, you know, with the jobs market cooling somewhat, but not falling apart, you know, I don't think it's recessionary or anything like that. You know, and the impact of tariffs on tightening, you know, pushing up prices of goods and things like that for consumers. Everything's not 100% rosy. There are things like that that are struggling. You know, the retail stocks in general have been kind of underperforming, broadly speaking, for a while now. So yeah, that's not perfect. But I think from a big picture standpoint, enough's going right and enough's likely to continue to go right, that I think you still want to be bold in your approach to this market.
Well, Mike, because you get to talk to so many different sector leaders and pundits and different fund managers and people that are thought leaders in different sectors at the Money Show, are there any themes that you're picking up from some of the shows you've done or the interviews you do as far as when some people may start taking some chips off the table? Like you say, there's a pretty rosy outlook. I think most people are pretty bulled up. Most sectors are breaking out, whether it's commodities, equities, cryptos, everything seems to be in melt-up mode. But are there any points that some of the speakers you talk to have mentioned where either technically or fundamentally or valuation-wise or sentiment-wise, they may start getting more defensive?
You know, I do think there is concern about AI and the bubble bust boom kind of question. I mean, you know, that does come up quite a bit. You know, we have bullish speakers on it. We have those who are sort of bullish on AI sideshow plays, again, utilities, think copper, data center type construction infrastructure plays. It's a topic of conversation that people say, how much is too much? You know, how much can a stock like Palantir go up, whatever it's up? I mean, the numbers are insane, 400, 500% in the last year. So yeah, you know, people talk, they're attracted to that, and there clearly is some question debate whether it's sustainable longer term. So that's on the minds of everybody. I would say that while people that I interact with, I did one of those polls, and you know, we had 450 or some odd people in the keynote hall in Toronto just when we were just at that conference. I basically did a show of hands. Are you bullish or bearish? And you know, let's say maybe 70, 80% of the crowd was bullish. But the conversations and the questions were not, oh my gosh, tell me where the next six bagger is or 10 bagger is. You know, how can I 10x my money? Blah, blah, blah. You know, Palantir hasn't gone enough, up enough for me kind of thing. I mean, it was still, there were still questions like, you know, why should, isn't this market risky? What's going to cause a bust? Shouldn't I be looking to sell here, lighten up? I mean, it was questions, you know, there were enough of those kinds of questions versus sort of a euphoric type environment that I still think the retail investor is not all in on this. You know, I don't get that same sense where it's just everybody's starry-eyed and euphoric. They're still concerned, and again, from a contrarian perspective, that's probably what you want to see if you think that the market can continue to climb.
So, Mike, really, it's all about kind of circling around to outperformance. Which sectors are outperforming? And Money Show, you release a best of report that outlines the, I believe, top 10 picks from recent conferences over the past about year or so. Take us through what was in that report. What is outperforming, and how should we view this report? If stuff has been outperforming for a while, will it keep leading?
Yeah, sure. So a little bit of background. Every year, not just since I joined Money Show in 22, but for many, many years before that, we've always done an annual report that we start soliciting top recommendations for the year ahead. Back in the December timeframe, we put this whole big report, 100 plus pages together, and release it at the beginning of the year. And it just, you know, it's from all of our contributors or as many contributors who respond. We ask for one pick that's a little more defensive, dividend oriented, one pick that's more growth focused. And you know, some do one, some do two, some just don't have time, whatever. So it's not always the same contributors, it's not always the same experts in certain sectors year to year. It generally is sort of an amalgam of experts in multiple sectors. Some people are dividend focused, some people are mining focused, some people are tech people, some people, you know, a little bit of everything. But what I always like to do around mid-year is go back to look at the performance table. I track everything in Yahoo Finance and see what's leading, and then go back to the contributors of the top 10 picks and say, hey, your picks at, you know, number three, number six, whatever. Tell me what your updated thoughts are on this stock. And what's interesting is this year, six or seven of those top 10 are mining companies of some sort, precious metals or rare earths and so on. So, you know, what does that tell you right there? It's not that I went out and got from 44 contributors, you know, 42 mining stocks or 84 mining stocks if you double it. It's just that those stocks are the ones that are severely or seriously outperforming. You know, one of them, a silver and gold miner, was up as of the tracking period 314%. So just since January. So that's an example of you know, again, when you talk about is the sector, the mining sector, overdone, it's certainly having an incredibly powerful bull run. You certainly have of the companies in this report or in this year's portfolio or pretend portfolio, model portfolio, whatever you want to call it, a lot of them are mining stocks. But you know, I still don't see that overly manic sort of, you know, we're really close to the edge, ninth inning, whatever you want to call it, type thing, tail end of the bull market. I mean, I know before we hopped on here, kind of off camera or off microphone, you know, we're talking about how to characterize the phase of the market for mining stocks. And I kind of look at it as, you know, we're not quite at the seventh inning stretch. We're getting closer. We're maybe in the sixth inning, but, you know, we're not in the ninth and we're not in the first, is the way I see it.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair take on it, Mike. And it's interesting to see that the mining stocks have done so well in that model portfolio. I guess it begs the question, we kind of live in the commodities universe here at the show, and we spend a lot of time on resource stocks. A lot of them have run. A lot of them are just getting running that are the smaller cap stocks. But do you think that translate over into the wider audience that you see at the Money Show as far as more people getting, I guess, awakened to the commodity sector or the potential gains and earnings in gold and silver stocks and copper stocks and rare earth stocks and uranium stocks? Do you think that's translating over into more people getting interested in raw materials?
You're seeing more of it as time goes on and as this bull market goes on. Yes. Again, I wouldn't characterize it as manic, as, oh my gosh, everybody wants to put, you know, all their money into metals and mining stocks and they don't care about anything else. We're certainly not near that, which is another reason why I think we're probably still have room to go in this bull market. I would say when it comes to the speculative element, people looking for, you know, as Eric Balchunas at Bloomberg would call it, the hot sauce in their portfolio, you know, they want to scratch that speculative itch. A lot of money and, you know, looking for those kinds of investments is still going to things like cryptocurrencies, is still going to things like AI and tech names, the Palantirs of the world. So that's where more people, though not all, are kind of finding the speculative element for their portfolios. We are seeing more interest gradually in that junior mining and that, you know, that part of the speculative arena. So it is happening. There is a shift, but again, it doesn't. You know, and again, it's more of a feeling. It's not quantitative. It's not something based on, you know, that I can put statistics and all that other type of stuff into. But just from my sort of qualitative sense, what I've seen, not just working at Money Show for the last few years, but attending Money Shows back to 2005, I don't think we're at that point where it's just, oh my gosh, everybody's all in, and that's a time when you want to be taking a ton of money off the table.
How about leadership? What are you seeing in terms of leadership? Because we definitely have seen money filter down to the juniors, but there's still a lot of solid companies. Even the majors have been making a new leg higher. Are you seeing this environment in the metal stocks, especially, well, precious metal stocks, as rising tide lifting everybody? Are you noticing certain ones being complete outperformers or garnering simply more attention from the people you talk to?
Sure. I mean, you know, I've always told you guys I'm not in the super, you know, specialty arena in this sector like you guys are. I mean, you talk to, you really are into the nitty-gritty of analyzing a lot of these junior companies, exploration companies, and so on. You know, you can analyze them inside and out. I come at it as sort of a generalist, so I can't really tell you, hey, you know, this sort of sub-subsector of the mining space is doing X, whereas this other sub-subsector is doing Y. I just look at it overall, where I, you know, again, whether it's names that I may pick up from specialists or names, you know, companies that I'll kind of, you know, hear about and listen to, or newsletters that cover the sector. You know, I'm still finding a lot of interesting ideas, but I think overall, you know, just even the ETFs are performing amazingly. I mean, you know, just as we're talking, pull up GDX and GDXJ, you know, 112.2% year to date for GDX and 114.3% for GDXJ. So it's almost no matter where you are in the sector, it's doing pretty darn well. And I think that that's, again, I think that part of it also, and I think, and again, you guys know this, the market cap of this sector relative to so many other parts of the market, I mean, it's minuscule, right? I mean, you know, so if big money, whatever the Fidelities and the BlackRocks and so on of the world, need to allocate money to mining stocks because their investors are saying, what the heck are you doing? You're missing out on this. It has a tremendous impact on the sector just because, unlike in like technology, which has an IPO every other day and the market cap's enormous and you can, you know, move billions of dollars here and there without driving the stocks up tremendously. It's a lot harder to do that in the mining space. So if the big money of the world goes from having 3% of their money in miners to 10% or 8% or even 5%, it has a pretty big impact across the space. And I think that's what you're seeing here.
Mike, I'm also curious if some of the executive orders and some of the things out of this administration that relate to, mineral development, and there's been four executive orders on nuclear power and uranium. There was tariffs on copper that were on again and then changed and then on again, off again, on again, but then they clarified it. And so a lot of people that couldn't spell commodities last year have probably seen all this administration action and said, what is going on with copper? Or why are we trying to develop critical minerals and rare earth projects? And why are there four executive orders on nuclear power? Do you think that's bringing any generalist into the fray that maybe just see all this activity and want to know what in the world's the deal with the commodity sector?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there because, look, government involvement in private enterprise, we can have a whole philosophical debate about whether it's a smart thing to do, whether it works long term. There's a million things I could say about that, but that's not really the purview of from an investor or trader standpoint, what do you do about it? And let's be honest, if the government is supporting a sector, is trying to improve its prospects, trying to help domestic producers of X, whether it's some of these rare earths, whether it's some of these other sectors, like you mentioned, relative to producers overseas, what's that going to do? You don't, why would you fight that? You want to get on board with it. I mean, one of the stocks that was in that report, I don't mind sharing the name, United States Antimony or Antimony, depending where you're from, how you pronounce that. I mean, that stock's up 200%+ year to date. And why is it up that much? Part of it's the demand, but part of it is that the US government's kind of backing it because it wants to make sure there's a supply of that particular mineral for things like defense and other sectors. So, again, argue the semantics if you want from a big picture standpoint, but if as an investor, what are you going to do? You want to kind of ride the or use that tailwind to your advantage. So yeah, I think that definitely is another factor here.
What about some of the other commodities then? Because copper is still doing pretty well, but it's not getting anywhere near the attention that precious metals are. But copper is a little over 460 right now. The energy sector, boy, oh boy, that's been boring, if not just straight out crappy. Crude stuck at 62. Nat gas is back under $3. These other kind of key commodity sectors, gold and silver really is just stealing the light here. So will we see money rotate in there, or are these just going to be laggards until the true precious metals bull narrative changes?
Yeah, you're right that it's definitely lag, but even there, I would kind of argue that copper and other metals are starting to follow what the path that gold and silver blazed initially. I mean, again, as we're talking, I just pulled up COPEX, the Global X Copper Miners ETF. It's up 38.7% year to date. That's not 102.9% like GDX, but it's better than a sharp stick in their eye, and it's triple the return of the S&P. Something like the PPLT, the Aberdeen Physical Platinum ETF, that's up 51.9%. Platinum, it's funny, it wasn't doing anything for a while. And 3 or 4 days after one of our speakers in Miami said, hey, this is going to be the next metal that you probably want to be involved in, boom, it started taking off and it's continued to do pretty well since then. So, each metals market, and as you said, the difference between metals and energy, totally different dynamics on supply, demand, and pricing there. So, you have to be a little discerning as an investor and focus on the parts of the commodities and materials market that make the most sense and that have the biggest drivers. But I do think, broadly speaking, it is broadening out somewhat, and it's probably going to continue to broaden out. The copper story, again, I've got, as a generalist, and I've got a lot of people telling me and people that I speak to on the podcast and at the events that know more about the sector. Like, look, given its conductivity, its sensitivity to, building the grid and electric vehicles and all that, it's going to be, something that's going to have a pretty favorable supply demand dynamic for a long time, not just, get it, buy it now because some mine got shut down or something that's short term,
Well, Mike, we've talked about a lot already with the US equity markets. We've talked about what's going on with the dollar on a trip lower. We've talked about the commodity sector seeing multiple bull markets in certain areas, but other areas that are laggards. I think one of the only sectors we haven't talked about is the cryptoverse. I know you have people at the Money Show that specialize on that. What is the chatter about cryptos, particularly Bitcoin and Ethereum, but just a broader comment if you have any?
Sure. I mean, I think that, it's a sector that's growing up, I guess, probably the way I describe it. I mean, it's maturing, it's becoming more institutionalized. More investors are able to invest in the sector because of things like ETFs and more investment committees that handle big money and family offices and all that and the other are, beginning to allocate to it. And I think that process is going to continue. So, long term, again, if you focus at sort of the top end of the spectrum, the Bitcoin, Ethereum kind of, level, you're not just trading around and you know what coins a little bit lower. I don't know if I'm allowed to say the word here on your podcast, but if you're focused on things that have real business cases that, have real money behind them, that the underlying blockchains and so on technology has use for other than, just rampant speculation, then, it's a it's proved crypto has proven itself as being part of the financial architecture and the financial system in the US and globally. And I don't th and I think that that is probably going to continue to evolve. So, whereas before it was just more of like a plaything and a sideshow, I think you do want to be allocated somehow to that part of the market and, watch what's happening as the technology unfolds. But I've said it before, or I'll say it again, and I'll probably say it to my dying day, that I don't think it replaces entirely in a portfolio, the whole digital gold versus actual gold or asset class. I don't think it replaces that because there's different attributes that both have and there's different uses that both have. So, I don't think we'll ever get to the point where it completely replaces that part of your portfolio that, or the benefits that you get from things like precious metals vis-a-vis crypto.
What about the whole use case of crypto or the blockchain? We've been hearing about it really since Bitcoin came out, is that blockchain is going to change the way we transact, the financial world, even in terms of contracts. It seems like that's still, again, being touted, but hasn't really come to fruition or taken over any industry. Do you see the whole use case transactionally wise for it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, there are things that the technology itself can improve. I mean, one of the speakers that in Miami talked about trying to use blockchain technology to, make it easier to buy and sell and property and transfer ownership and make sure you re record transfers of ownership in real estate much better than the current system, which is, god awful and focused on paper and scanning and all this, faxing things here back and forth. So, I think that there's things like tokenization of assets, buying fractional shares of different kinds of asset classes that you can, use blockchain technology to make that process easier. There are things like that that I think, are real actual things that you can use the technology for. And again, I'm no expert. Just like I told you guys earlier, I'm not going to be able to read a drilling report and get the same thing away from take away the same thing from that you guys would as being experts in the space. I'll say the same thing about crypto. I'm not going to be able to tell you every little nitty-gritty thing that, this particular token or crypto, the underlying technology for that one, how it's different from another, but I'll follow the experts and I'll read the experts and I'll listen to the experts who do know, and then hopefully take away some, investable nuggets from that.
Well, Mike, with that caveat, have you heard any speakers talk about the emerging trend of more and more companies holding Bitcoin on their balance sheets and kind of being a crypto repository and/or the crypto mining companies? There's about a dozen of them now. And so between those two things, those are equities that people can trade kind of outside of the sphere of the cryptos themselves. Any thoughts on either of those markets, the crypto repositories or the crypto miners?
Yeah, again, we might be getting a little into the weeds there and out of my area of expertise. I'll just say simply that if more companies are putting it on their crypto, different whether it's Bitcoin, Ethereum, or some of these other, high-level crypto projects, tokens, if more companies are putting it on their balance sheet as balance sheet asset, whereas before they might have just owned treasuries or corporate bonds or other, stores of value, the fact that money is migrating into there and it's not just, this high risk money and people, gambling a few hundred dollars on something. It's companies investing multi-billions of dollars on and putting this stuff on their balance sheet. What does that tell you? That's just another form of the institutionalization of this part of the market and the acceptance in this part of the market. And so, it just speaks to the fact that this is an asset class that's going to be around and something that you can capitalize for a long, long time.
All right, enough said, Mike. Thank you so much for joining us on this weekend show. Again, Mike Larson, editor-in-chief at Money Show. visit our website, podcast, YouTube channel. Click the link in the show notes. That's where you can learn more about the upcoming Money Show, where Chad and I will be going to the February one in Las Vegas. We'll have more news about that as that show approaches. Everyone, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. Keep in touch with Chad and I through email. We love hearing from each and every one of you. And be sure to go back through our website, podcast, YouTube channel, and Substack page to listen to all the daily editorials and company updates that we release throughout the week. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Thanks, guys. Take care.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.